Paul Mayer's Children's Television Archive.
Pushing them. We all need a director, you know, somebody you trust. And I think that's been lacking with him for a while. So anyway, she made this thing.
I'm sorry, are you talking about...
The work puppet.
Yeah.
The work puppet. Yeah, and that was just to be used for rehearsals and so on. Then she worked on a very elaborate thing where smoke would be pumped out and come out through the nostrils.
Are you talking about your wife now?
My wife, yeah, making the original season. Yeah.
Was that the first kind of thing that she did along that line? Or was
she'd always been pretty good with the needle, mm-hmm. you know, the sewing machine and all that.
I understood that I haven't talked with Bob in depth with this, and I will be speaking with him.
Yeah.
But I understood that he had the Cecil character developed a long time before that.
That's what he says. I mean, what I'm saying now, you can kill. It doesn't matter
after
all these years.
Sure.
But he says that his mother had a Cecil, and he used to play with it in his bathtub, which is, pardon the expression, BS, you know, because this is the first time Cecil ever came to life when I suggested it.
He may have had a crude kind of sock puppet, but,
something like that. But it wasn't what I mean at the time. Who knows? Your mind can't be that retentive. He might have said, "Gee, I had something like that when I was a kid, and I forgot it."
But the collaboration of these creative forces kind of coughed up the character, and
it was like a séance, you know. So it did come to being. So she made this little work puppet, and we did some auditions with that. And we finally got Klaus Landsberg at KTLA this spring. He wanted to do the show. So then we're going to bring out this beautiful, big, elaborate Cecil. And nobody liked it because it was mean. It was ferocious. And then when it turned out to be funny, that was because I was on. But it was just too ferocious. And I can't think of a corollary, like some great dramatic actor doing stand-up, you know. So they said, use the old one. So they got this old work puppet that my wife had made, and that was Cecil. And he was the hit of the show.
So did they use this other kind of scary kind of character for a while?
No, never.
No.
Never used.
There was just nothing to relate with. I mean, he's scared of him.
Yeah.
You know, and he's mean.
Yeah, but the other one was funny, see? In other words, the very fact that he was a sea serpent, just to say it's a sea serpent is scary.
And he made friends with this boy.
And he made friends with the little boy. And the great thing was he's going to the moon, and they said, "Oh, a sea serpent," and so forth. And we had lightning, which was just a cutout, you know. And we had it on a stick, and that would go in, and, you know, typical thing.
Well, that's fun.
But when Cecil said, "Oh, so so-and-so, he has this funny voice and all that," he said, I'm seasick. You know, he really played the seasick bit. It was so funny that from the rehearsal, from the show that sold the show, Cecil was the character, you know. Then later, Dishonest John and other things that Stan did. And I'd say that Stan was really, of the two of us, he was the best puppeteer. His genes just flowed through those things.
So you didn't do any taping? You really worked? Did you
Kinescope. We all worked the puppets. But I mean, I was doing more of the straight men. You know, like one time Charlie didn't write anything for Beanie, and he loved me. Charlie and I were great friends, but he adored Cecil. See, that was his character. He was the Svengali, you know, and he wrote lines for him and songs and whoa, that was it. So this one show, I didn't realize until we got to rehearsal. I said, "Charlie, you know, there's one line in there for Beanie." And he had him walking into the scene, you know, and all the things. So finally in the show, Stan and I ad-libbed. I'm doing the captain talking to Cecil, and Cecil said, "Why doesn't the kid ever say anything?" I said, "Yeah, that's right. I was saying, hey, Beanie, you just stand there. You don't say anything." I said, "I got no lines." "Kid's got no lines." "Well, then he shouldn't say anything. If the kid's got no lines, he don't say no lines." And then he said, "Why don't you just walk out of the scene?" "Okay, I'll see you around." "Okay, kid." Well, he had a line at that, you see, and it was brilliant.
Yeah.
And people knew that we were ad-libbing, and that. But there's an example. Cecil was the thing. You wrote to Cecil, and it was a brilliant, brilliant character. That, like the Moon Man he does now, is nothing compared to Cecil. It's garbage. But so that was the relationship. That lasted for 5 years. You know, 5 days a week, 5 years. And
you say you didn't want to work at a local station. Now, that was that all it was doing at the time?
It was about 50 areas. Yes. It was a 35 syndicated. Millimeter kinescope. See, now at that time, that was good kinescope, 35 millimeter. So that went to all the stations that could handle it. And we were in about 39 to 50 areas.
So it really was a pretty good move for you.
Oh, yeah, it was a marvelous move. Fantastic. Sure. Oh, sure. And then it was just after that that Stan... Now, that's another example. You see, my confidence still hadn't come up. And now this is an example of things that I haven't gotten into talking to kids about yet because it's a little heavy. And I don't want it to sound like sour grapes. But here I had... two children by that time. We weren't making a lot of money on Beanie. We started out like $50 a piece for a week. Can you imagine? We finally ended up after 5 years at $500 a week. It's $100 a day, which is nothing. And then we got out. But I couldn't not do the show. It was security. I was at least I had that. And yet there were nights when I used to lie awake and look at the ceiling and figure, God, I'd rather do anything than this.
Well, you did you have an exclusive contract with him? I mean, were you able to do other things, or did that take all your time?
Oh, yeah, we could do other things, but the trouble is people had turned off, and we weren't pushing that hard. But I did a radio show once in a while, and commercials and things like that. But there wasn't that much coming in, and people were forgetting that we weren't just puppeteers, you see. By the time the thing was over, it took me a year to break into writing for commercials. That's when I started to write. And then I wrote for a couple of years and did all the voicing and all the animation and all these great reels.
That's another in for you.
That's another in, you see. But everything with the conflict, always working through the conflict. But at this point, we were kind of unhappy, and we didn't really get along that well with Clampett. And the money was terrible. And he wanted exclusivity. He didn't want us to have any more credit than he could allow. I mean, the very fact that we were in the titles was murder to Clampett. We went to New York to be on Ed Sullivan when we wrote St. George and the Dragonette. He sent a telegram to Ed Sullivan saying, no mention of time for Beanie. Oh, that no tie-in. Whereas to the average public, they say, who the hell what's time for Beanie? You see, they knew who Ed Sullivan was. They knew what St. George and the Dragonette was because it was a million seller. You know, it was a big deal. But that's just to thine own self be true. In other words, it was a great show to Clampett, and it was a great show.
Was he always there on the set, or?
He would usually be there, or somewhere in the wings, or the periphery, or in his dressing room, or listening, or watching on the TV. But it's something I wouldn't go into because it was...
You don't have to.
It's one of those psychological...
Huh? You don't need to. I find it interesting, but you don't need to.
No.
Yeah.
It's, as I say, it's water over the dam, like my wife says. Forget it, you know, don't... And I don't like to hold grudges or anything else. But it was at a time when you're like this. In other words, you've got to do it. And so then standard somebody you love is the fact that Charlie did like Dishonest John and Cecil, and it was all written to the comedy. So the captain, who was very subtle, there was people who knew in those days, saw great humor in the captain. But he was like a light W.C. Fields. There were nuances and shadings and things I was putting in, which were not like Mortimer Snurd. They were not obvious, you know.
He's kind of a mysterious character.
And he was a mysterious character, yeah. And then he was the coward. He didn't want to go into danger. He put somebody else out. And he was the fall guy. But the thing that hurt was that Cecil was such a big character and Dishonest John and things that Stan did, that when anybody came backstage, the first thing they'd say was, who does Cecil? Who does Dishonest John? And I'm standing there with egg on my face. You know, it's almost like you're ashamed to say, I do the captain. You see, it was a secondary...
And the name of the show is really Beanie and Cecil.
Well, yeah, that's right. Well, that's what they... It was time for Beanie, really. But but to the average person, they'd say the Cecil show. Beanie was secondary. And yet, by my doing straight and playing the Cecil, you see, that really brought him out. It's the way I've done with all the things with Hanna-Barbera, the Augie Doggy, Augie Daddy relationship, you know.
And how did you develop your voice for Beanie? I mean, did Bob give you a rundown of the kind of character that he wanted? Or?
No, it was just a kid voice, and he was vulnerable, and he was little, and he was going on adventures all over the world.
Innocence.
With his uncle. Innocence, yeah. So he'd say, Cecil, you're my favorite sea serpent.
And he'd say, how many sea serpents do you know?
I'd say, one.
Thanks a lot.
You know. So, I mean, it was, but Beanie didn't mean that. Mm-hmm. He really meant that if there were more sea serpents, he would be the favorite. The fact that there's only one doesn't negate it in his mind. That's the innocence, you see. Mm-hmm. And there was a great love between the two. And when Cecil would, you know, slurp Beanie when he'd been lost, and Cecil found him and saved him, kids used to dissolve in tears, you know, when they were separated. It was a marvelous relationship. Hmm. It was my first real adventure in a strong relationship. And that's why I decry the networks now and these mutants, you know, that they don't understand. But I was in a secondary seat. It was killing my ego, you know. So then when the record came along and Stan said, gee, I was getting an idea for doing a takeoff on Dragnet. How'd you like to write it with me? I said, great, you know. And then we sat down to write it, and yet a big part of the writing was mine. And I know that. I know which gags are mine, which situations, the knave, the dragon, what's a 412, the characters, the rhythms of it, the writing it together, my sticking to my last and getting the damn thing done and not doing it over and over and over, which Stan fell into later. Because when he was with me, we would turn things out. We'd knock out two sides to a record in a day.
You worked well with each other.
We worked great.
You were friends.
We were great collaborators. Yeah. Collaborators. Yeah. So, but even when that came out, Stan had the contract with Capitol. He got the full credit for starring Stan Freberg, and that I was doing the dragon, the knave. June was doing the gal that got burned, you know, the grandmother, Little Red Riding Hood.
I guess that's something you run into all the time, just being a voice man, not getting enough credit.
That's right. And yet, in a way, I blame Stan because I don't think I would have done it. In other words, I think that my sense of ethics and morality would have said, I want Butler's name on there too. I want June's name on
yeah,
there.
Yeah, you know, that must be really frustrating because I tend to think that the cartooning producers don't really like to have these names on there because it's really not necessary to them. They'd rather have the full credit. And I kind of wonder, too, if they really want to admit to the children that there is a voice man behind the character.
But of course, it all goes back to business. It's the more important you become, the more you may cost the next time they do it. And if, I don't know if you saw the Thanksgiving show, but there were like 25 cuts of cartoons that I was basically responsible for. Not one mention of me, Don Messick, Mel Blanc, anybody. But Gene, what you call it, the dancer, you know, was up there all the way through the damn thing. For what reason?
Yeah, you know, if you play the cartoons without the sound, you have absolutely nothing.
There's no
you have
animation.
Pictures and walking around that are basically pretty simple.
That's right, sure. So, but there was another case of not getting the credit. Everybody was going, hey, Freberg and the great thing, St. Charlie, we go on interviews, we always stand, you know, sometimes. So in a sense, there's an example of where I talked before about how you play into the opportunity. And then when Stan was going to do his radio show, he had some guy he was working with who was a much more seasoned writer who had done a lot of big things in New York. And they had meetings, and I went out to see him. And this is where courage comes in, because I was still not out of the woods.
Well, if you're dotted with that much frustration, you begin to have courage, don't you
think?
Well,
sure, you have to.
Get frustrated.
You get up against the wall. See?
Yeah.
So anyway, they said something about, we'd like you to work on the radio show and work on the writing with us. And I said, well, would that be the Butler and Freberg and Butler show? I said, no, it'd be the Stan Freberg show, but you'd be getting good money and be writing with us and doing the editing and the final thing. And we'll get material from other sources and put it together. And you'll be up there with Stan, and you'll be like the strong character man. Stan will be leading the show, and he'll be the protagonist.
You'll be the sidekick.
You'll be the sidekick, and you'll be all your variations of characters, see? And that's not my fault that I can do a lot of stuff, you see? So I said, no, I said, I don't really want to do it. I said, if it was Freberg and Butler, I would do it. And that ended it. And then we did the shows, and they did call me, and Peter Leeds, and June Foray, and Jed Conlon Singers, and Billy Mays Orchestra. And it was a smash, and it's a classic of a kind. It's a summer show that ran for 15 shows, and there's some material on there that is still undated and brilliant. And then when it was all over, this is another case where this wasn't even my agent doing this. I said this myself, where Stan called me up, and, you know, the friendship thing. And he said, we want to put out an album, the best of the Stan Freberg shows. And we figured you pay you and Junie and Peter, you know, like $500 for be a two-record album, you know, which scale-wise might have covered it. And I said, and I'm not that much of a businessman.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I said, no, I said, I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't give any rights to you to any of my material for less than $1,500. So because I said that, June got $1,500 and Peter Leeds got $1,500. You see? But I figured to hell with it. And then I walked over to work on Green Christmas with Stan, because that was all his. I only did Bob Cratchit, which was still one of my favorite characters, because it was strong, sympathetic, a religious character in a sense, because he was the voice of reason. There's
a lot you can do with it.
Oh, it was a good dramatic part. When I said, it's later than you think, Bob, I said, I know, Mr. Scrooge, I know. And my little heart was going pity-pat. I mean, that was acting. I was saying it with my traumatic self, you see. That was fine. But he screwed around and screwed around and went into like 2.5 sessions before he got around to me or something. And I charged him for 3 sessions. So where I might have gotten $200 for going in and doing it, I got $600. I figured, the hell with it. You know, why should I let him get away with it?
You've got to draw a line somewhere between being good buddies with him and trying to make a living.
And where's money? Sure, that's right. So, I mean, I love Stan. I revere him. I admire him. We both have weak points and all of that, but I wouldn't want to work with him anymore. You see what I mean? And part of it, you say, well, what the hell? And I say, well, Stan's a nice guy. He always likes me. He respects me. I'm sure we love each other, you know. But I say at that time is when he should have stood up to be counted. He should have said, no, Butler gets credit. Okay, let Butler come in. Let it be the Freeburg and Butler show. What the hell's the difference? Because we had done other little things that didn't succeed, like the one in there you saw with the big cowboy hat and us doing High Noon. We did for ABC pilot shows that didn't come off called the Freeburg and Butler Show. But this, the fact that it was going to be the full network on CBS, something about Stan said, my ego demands that it's got to be me up there in the marquee. You know, it's like...
It must be difficult to swallow that when...
Well, it is, especially when you know what you've contributed.
Yeah.
You see, if I was doing a little piddly type thing, you'd figure, what the hell, I'm happy to be in there. But...
There was a lot of hurt involved there.
Sure. Yeah. But because of the hurt, that's the conflict. That's the conflict. That's why now, I'll say sometimes your conflict on a commercial is an actor that's working against you that doesn't even know you're there. You're trying to help with eye contact, with readings, etc. He is reading his lines the way he's going to read them regardless of what you do. And the director is giving you, either one of you, nothing. He's giving neither of you anything. So that is your conflict, a bad co-worker, a bad script. You've got to make it as good as you can. You shape and phrase it to make it as good as you possibly can. When it's all over, they may say, gee, that was a heck of a job. They don't realize that it would have been a lousy job if you'd read it the way it was. So I go way back to Pilgrim's Progress, the conflict. You've got to have the conflict. Mm-hmm. And in the end, it makes you stronger.
So was that your last workings with Stan?
Just about. Then we did about 5 records together, mm-hmm. you know, The Lone Psychiatrist and whatever. But then, and on that radio show, but then from about 1940, well, that was in 1957 or so, and it was in 58 that the Huckleberry Hound started and Jay Ward started. So then I went off into a whole new world. Mm-hmm. And then Captain Crunch started about 1959.
Now, you mentioned Walter Lance. When did you start?
About 1953.
About 53.
Mm-hmm. And that went up to about 5 years ago.
Now, you did a Penguin for him?
I did Chilly Willy. I did a dog, a southern dog called Smedley. Mm-hmm. Now that's another interesting thing. Tex had been at MGM and he created the wolf character with a southern accent. Then MGM went down the drain and he went over to work for Walter Lance. He was only there about 6 months, but he created Smedley.
He liked
which
that character.
The same character.
Yeah.
And even had funnier non sequiturs. And he had a gag where Smedley was out in the backyard, I think, and I think it was Smedley. And a big bulldog comes up and grabs onto his rear end, you know. And he goes, yeah, runs all around, so finally shakes the dog off and he goes off. And then he gets another thing, goes, bah, right in his rear end. And then the third time he says, joke's over, son. Typical Tex Avery line, joke's over. So the dog goes and walks away. Like he's a performer, he knows when you've killed a dead horse, you're trying to. And I did that, and then after Tex left, then Alex Lovey came in, and other directors, and I did Smedley for 53, 63, for at least 15 years. And I did an alligator character. I don't even remember their names, you know.
What was your penguin character?
That was Chilly Willy.
Chilly Willy.
And that only came in about the last 6 or 7 years of its, because before that it had always been mute. Mm-hmm. But Chilly Willy didn't have much to say, but what he said was very quick and very brisk and like,
I'm cold. I want to go inside. Wait for me. I want to go too.
So you never really did any speeding up with that at all?
No, I never did any speed up.
You never needed to?
No. So I've always had good long runs.
What was it like to work for Walter Lantz?
Walter?
Yeah. What was that group like?
Walter to me was always, you know, like Disney and all the rest of them, he's pretty slow with the buck, you know. And like my agent would get after me after I'd worked for him for 5 or 6 years. And at that time, $125 for a cartoon was considered over scale. Scale might have been about 90, but it wasn't long before the 125 had almost been bypassed. And it would be
but
like
he was always pretty healthy in that area. I mean, he had a pretty good budget. He was always pretty successful.
Oh, yeah, he was very successful. But they still didn't want to pay the talent any more than they had to, you know, or the directors or writers or anybody. And so Miles would always say, well, we ought to, you know, tell Walter to up it and so forth. And I said, Miles, I only do about 6 cartoons a year. I like Walter. I like Gracie, Alex. I said, it isn't that big a deal if I was making $750. That's worth fighting for. But it was only going to be another $25 or $50. What difference does it make? And your commission is going to amount to nothing. But my agent is a purist. He's an honest man. He does it for the principal entirely, not what he's going to get. And he's worked out some fantastic deals for me. Like these 5 specials that Hanna-Barbera is doing now. He's got a tremendous deal. And we'll start doing those next week. So he didn't bother me, and I just went ahead and did him. And I have a great affection for Walter. He would always come down to the session. I don't think he was the world's greatest director.
And was that in his own studios?
Well, that was over TV recorders, you know, at Goward and Sunset. And... but it was almost like a family affair. I would go over to the studios on Seward, go upstairs in the writer's room. Gracie would come in, and we'd read through the lines with the writer and the guys, the animator. And then we'd go downstairs. Walter would have the car brought around. We'd all get in the big limousine, go over to the recording studio, you know.
By the way,
he's like, he wanted us to read through it and be aware of the things that maybe to save studio time. I don't know.
Yeah. Gracie was on that program the other day, too.
Was she?
Live, yeah. And Walter was on the program and Mel Blanc.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it was interesting to see her because I don't think the public has seen her in public. I don't think she does much.
Very nice lady. Yeah. And yet, the funny part of it was every time we do those Woody Woodpeckers, and they had that speed-up machine. And you'd think, you know, I mean, how much could a person's voice change? This was a woman's voice to begin with. And she'd say, ha, 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 do the bit. And they'd say, what cycles have you got? We got a 62, Walter. Try it at 64. Yeah, and so, and it was really not that critical. It was like I say in the networks, they try to make their job important. It really doesn't matter. But that they would get that set, that'd be the proper speed, then Gracie would do her lines and I would do my lines, and we'd put them together and we'd drive us back to the studio, we'd pick up our own cars and go home. But it was a friendly, nice kind of an association, and sometimes I get into a position where I don't want money to be a part of it. Unless it's a lot of money, the difference between $50 and $500, that's something worth toying with, you know. But if it's just a little bit over scale or something, or scale plus 10, it isn't that important. And sometimes you'd like to do it.
It sounds like the Walter Lantz staff was pretty well organized, which avoided a lot of frustration.
Oh,
which,
sure, and they worked there for years.
As you said, Bob Clampett didn't really have his act together when you came, and you had to do a lot of knocking around.
There's nothing. It wasn't until Charlie came in that we got Freeberg. And the funny part about Freeberg, he was working with, of all people, doing a stand-up thing with Red Fox. You know, it was the dirtiest guy in the world. Stan was doing a very clean minister's son routine with funny jokes. He did John and Marcia. That was a stand-up thing before he ever made a record of it. And so anyway, Clampett knew Freeberg, and he worked at Warner Brothers and was aware of him, and he was like a young bull in a china shop, you know. And so he was going to get Stan to do sound effects on the show. That was, he was going to do the sound of the wind and the, I don't know what else, that, just funny sounds. I was doing all the acting, you see. And I don't know if it was because of the fact that he was taller, he'd get the sea serpent higher or what, but he ended up doing the Cecil. And there was some guy on, I don't know who, whether he was doing Mortimer Snerd or what, but that was like the takeoff of what he was doing for the dumb guy, you know. And so he ended up doing Cecil, which became the hit of the show. And yet he was called in to do a sort of a peripheral thing. So that's the way things work, you see. But now here's an example. This is something you would never use, mm-hmm. but from a moral or ethical standpoint, about why I think Stan should have stood up for me when the, when that point was there. And he could have, because he was very big in Capital. And it would have been, they would have accepted it immediately, just saying it, you know. Like the Doubting Thomas thing and the hand in the side.
It never would have been detrimental to his career.
No,
to have,
it would have only made
to
it
share,
better.
Yeah.
Yeah. But he didn't want to share. So, but when it started out, I was getting $75 a week. Can you imagine, for 5 days? Stan was getting 50 because he had been signed to do sound effects. And I realized very soon that Cecil was the character. I mean, I had enough sense to know that I was being avalanched. And so when it came 6 months and the time for, the contract was always renewed every 6 months. We had no way of getting out, really. But Clampett could always have killed it every 6 months. You know, we had options and so on. So when it came to the next 6 months, I was like, going to go to 100, Sam was going to go to 75. And I said, I'd rather we stay the same. I'll either stay at 75 or have Freeberg go to 100. But I don't think there should be a disparity in our wages. And it never, and that was said and it never changed. We always made the same money.
And so you had hoped by doing this that Freeberg would help you later along the line.
I don't know if I did or not. I don't know if I did. I wasn't able to accept it.
No, that just seemed fair. It just seemed fair to you.
I was.
Yeah, yeah.
And I figured, why should I? He be making less than I am, you see? And I think, and I was older, of course. I was 10 years older. And I was.
But what I'm saying is that later when you worked with, when you came down to sharing a bill with him, you ran back in your head
yeah,
to this moment.
That's right. I did it then. Why doesn't he do it now? But those are things that happen, and yet there was an article that came out on me in the Los Angeles Times about 2 or 3 years ago. The hell of an article. It was like Metro, and it covered the whole first page. It was transferred on the inside.
Do you remember who interviewed it? Because I can get a copy.
Yeah, well, I've got the guy's name in the house.
Okay.
It was a beautiful... It was factually right on the money. Gosh, the guy came over like you did, and he didn't even have a tape recorder. He just took it down in shorthand, you know.
It's amazing.
Old line reporter, you know. But he had contacted Freeberg, and Freeberg said a lot of things. I wasn't even aware of this until the thing appeared in the Sunday paper. Got a lot of coverage. A lot of people saw it, and with pictures and the whole bit. And Freeberg said, you know, this is like after it's all over, he said, I got credit for a lot of things that Butler should have gotten credit for. You see? So he admitted it. He likes to wash the linen.
He said this to you?
No, he said it in the article.
Oh, I see.
To the interviewer. And he said, Doss was the guy that did this, and in the records we did.
So he interviewed you, and he
interviewed
everyone.
And then he interviewed Freeberg, but I didn't know that. And then when the thing finally appeared, I saw these little, you know, quoted things from Freeberg.
Mm-hmm.
So all I knew was what I had told him.
Did that surprise you that this interviewer went to...
No. Because I know that they try to find things that are part of your curriculum or your past and so on. But there's an example. In other words, Stan is older now. See, I'm 61, Stan's 51. But when we started out, I was 30 and he was 20. And 20 is, you know, 20 is, you're pretty close to it. And
well, I'm so 25 now, but 20 seems like a long time ago, but I know what you mean.
Sure.
Yeah, you're really... You're still a child. Still,
yeah.
Expanding.
And the whole world was there, and he wanted it. And So a lot of things colored his thinking. So he could talk himself out of things in a minute, or a guy could say, oh, what the hell, Stan, you got the contract. Should be your name. He'd say, yeah, you're probably right. You see? And he could go with it because he wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
But now he realizes, and yet, as I say, nothing has ever affected our relationship. It's like he probably has things he says about me. I don't mean them in a derogatory sense. I just mean them in a way that, why didn't I have enough guts at the time? See, finally, on one record we did, Point of Order, which was the takeoff on McCarthy. I think that was the one. I said something to Stan, a Christmas Dragnet. I don't know if you ever heard that. That's the one about Grudge. And
I've heard it somewhere along the line, but I can't I can't place it. You
but
know?
That was a brilliant.
But I think that it is something that is replayed a number of times around Christmas time on the radio. Yeah,
that's right.
I think that's
about
where I've heard it.
Scallions and green onions and a little brownie. And to me, one of the best things we ever wrote together. But on that, we got co-credit. It was starring Stan Freberg and Doss Butler. Yes. No, not even on that, because he said, we were going to, and he said, I've never had a Christmas record. I'd like to have it my own credit. So then it was the next one, which I think was the McCarthy thing, and it says, Point of Order, starring Stan Freberg and Doss Butler.
Go home and bang the walls.
That's right. So, but the great patience, like people say to me now, how can you be so patient with these students you have?
Yeah, yeah.
And I go over and over and over things, and I'll say, you've got to see that the pronoun is important in that sentence. That's the only important word in that whole sentence. And say, why do you always have to tell me? I'll say, I have to keep telling you until you can find it yourself, you know. But I say the breakthrough, the fulfillment is worth it. So you develop a certain patience.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned that when you were with Tex Avery, that you, that's through that association, was when you first met William Hanna and Hanna-Barbera. Did you start working for them right away and doing little spots now and then?
Within 6 months, I'd say, I was working on our animated cartoons, theatricals.
Uh-huh. Now, what would be the date that you first started doing that?
Well, I probably started working for Tex around somewhere in 1946. And probably in that same year, I did a couple of things for Hanna-Barbera. See, Tom and Jerry were always mute, but they would have characters in there, like a cop or the father of the house would say something to Tom. Might be only a line or two, mm-hmm. but they needed somebody to say it. So Tex probably said, gee, I got this guy, Doss Butler, is very good. And
good at filling the gaps.
So it filled in the gaps, yeah. And they got to know me, and I did enough things, and I was doing a character like Yogi Bear for a dog for Bill and Joe, and so I may even forget the name of it. And when they started their own company, they wanted to build a character around that voice.
Not droopy, is it?
No, it wasn't droopy. No. It was the Art Carney type thing, which later became, with the great ebullience, the Yogi Bear thing. But I was the first one they thought about, and Don Messick. And I had gotten Don Messick out there, I think I told you, because Bill Thompson was in New York and needed somebody to do Droopy. And I said, Don Messick does the best Droopy next to Bill Thompson.
I'm very familiar with Don Messick's voice, but I don't know anything about him. He's totally mysterious to me.
Yeah, well, he's
I've seen things about you, man. You know, like I've seen a few spots here and there.
Yeah. Well, Don lives, he is a very private person, and I don't know. It's not that publicity is so important, but I feel that anything that happens to me, which accrues to my benefit, rubs off on the people I'm teaching. See, if people in town have a great respect for me, like all the agents, I can send anybody to an agent with a demo tape and they'll listen to them because they respect me. Well, that's valuable, but they have to be aware of what I'm doing, the commercials, the this, and having little things in the trades and whatever. So that's the main thing. It's what is the end-all result?
Mm-hmm. And so you worked with Tom and Jerry at MGM, first with Hanna-Barbera,
mm-hmm.
and then you stayed with them. How many years have you been with them?
Well, they started, you can figure about 10 years doing cartoons. I probably did.
It seems as though they've been around longer than that, doesn't
it? Well, they were. Oh, sure. They've probably been doing cartoons. I didn't start till about 46, but they were probably doing around 1935 or so. And they were both young men. They were probably in their 20s mm-hmm. when they started. So anyway, I worked with them on and off with Tex, with Bill and Joe over the years till 1958 when Huckleberry Hound started. First it was Rough and Ready, then Huckleberry Hound. But they called me out and Don to do narration, he to do Rough, me to do Ready, to use my southern voice again, mm-hmm. you see. Then that went into Huckleberry Hound, Yogi Bear, and the whole thing started growing. But it was because in those days, they were in the producer's seat. They were allowed to make the decisions, not the networks. They didn't audition 50 people to see who were going to do Rough and Ready. They just called us in and said, you're going to do Rough and Ready. Because they liked us, they knew we were good. That's all that was necessary. That's the way it should be now.
So how did you sit down, they gave you a profile of the character, and then you just started knocking some voices out in front of them until they said, hey, I like that.
Yeah, well, they told the dog was supposed to be Ready, was the southern voice. And I'd done that for Tex, and they were very familiar with that. And Don, they knew, had a little voice like I did, and that would be a good contrast. He did that. And we probably just kicked it around for 15 or 20 minutes. And then within a few weeks, we were doing the track, and they were animating him. And then they sold it to whatever station or network it was. We were on the air. Then within a year, we were doing Huckleberry Hound, Yogi Bear, Quick Draw, all those things.
Now, Huckleberry Hound was your first...
That was the first one.
Biggie.
Huckleberry Hound was 4 minutes of the segment, Yogi Bear and Mr. Jinx and Pixie and Dixie. Mm-hmm. And then by 1 year, Yogi had gained such stature that he had his own show, and that was with Hokey Wolf and Snagglepuss. You know, it was like each one grew out of another, like a Dr. Seuss marching band, one horn coming out of another.
Reminds me of the Mary Tyler Moore Breakaways.
Where yeah, that's came. Right, sure. That's what it was. It was what do they call that, a spinoff.
Yeah.
And so for 5 years, and Kellogg was the sponsor all that time, and my God, I made
and
a
you did
fortune
things,
on
yeah, you did things for Kellogg
oh, sure.
as well.
I had a character in every box of cereal. You know.
So you would sometimes do Yogi the Bear, and then the commercials would come on, and then you'd be doing the commercials.
That's right. Yeah. Sure, on the same program. Because they sponsored the whole half hour.
Yeah, yeah.
So they were really the golden days, you know, of animation. And as I say, Don is a private person, but a very good friend, and I've known him since 1945. My God, that's over 30 years. But Don just doesn't get... See, he doesn't write as I do.
Paul Mayer's Children's Television Archive.